Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, September 2nd, 2014. Women farmers learn how to run their own business in a week-long workshop.
They have different crops that they grow. They grow peanuts, they grow maize, they grow simsim, cassava, and even sugar cane. And some of the women are trying to grow even these Irish potatoes.
And health workers say sexual transmitted diseases are becoming a concern at overcrowded IDP camps in Juba.
In our death record, we have more than 3 cases that are recorded, and they are all positive.
We'll have these stories and more coming up. From bilateral to multilateral and now back to bilateral, that's how the peace talks for South Sudan seem to be shaping up in Addis Ababa. Today, the head of a South Sudanese opposition party that has been taking part in the talks say he thinks the warring parties should be the only ones participating at the negotiations. Other groups, including his own party, should only contribute ideas. But as Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba, he has not always thought that way.
The leader of the United Sudan African Party, or USAP, Joseph Ukel Abango, told the reporters in Juba today that early on in the peace process, his party backed the idea of the talks involving numerous stakeholders. But now he says it does not make sense to involve several different parties in the talks. He says all the parties at the talks consider themselves to be essential to the success of the peace process. But President Salva Kiir's government and former Vice President Riek Machar's opposition movement have to be left to sort out their differences between themselves. Other stakeholders and even the mediators at the talks, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, need to play a secondary role, says Abango.
USAP believes that there is no prospect for peace unless IGAD mediators become impartial and do not dictate the views of the principal parties. The principal parties is the government delegation and the SPLM, SPLA in opposition.
When the peace talks began in January this year, only the government, Machar's rebels and the IGAD mediators were at the negotiating table. A few months later, IGAD and the warring sides agreed that the talks should include members of civil society groups, faith-based organizations and opposition political parties and individuals. But now the government and opposition are both saying they want the talks to be between them only. Abango agrees.
USAP believes that the stakeholders, political parties, former detainees, civil society, and church-based, they should adhere to the advisory role.
Last week, IGAD adjourned the talks in Addis Ababa to allow for consultations. The adjournment came after both sides agreed to a blueprint for finally moving ahead with a ceasefire signed in January, although Machar's side has denied that they agreed to the so-called matrix. The talks are expected to resume in 2 weeks. Abango says several parties at the multilateral talks are putting their own interests first when they need to focus on ending the crisis.
Stop the war. Let us see what we can What are the solutions that we should make? And one of them is formation of the government of national unity. And then we come here now where the stakeholders, USAP will now come up and say, what is our share in the transitional government? But not now.
Last month, leading South Sudanese think tank, the Sud Institute, also proposed that the peace talks be confined to the government and rebels. The Sud Institute says that would be the fastest way to enter the crisis. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
We tried to reach IGAD for comment, but were unavailable. Women farmers and small-scale entrepreneurs in Central Equatorial State's Morobo County say they are the area's poor infrastructure and their lack of skills are just some of the challenges they face in growing their business. To remedy the problem, Central Equatoria's Gender and Social Welfare Development Ministry has sent more than 100 female farmers and small business owners from Morobo to train them on how to manage their businesses. Philip Thornaleu reports for VOA from Juba.
Central Equatoria state officials know female farmers have a tough road ahead of them, so they are trying to help by putting together this workshop on business management skills and new farming techniques. Helen Kamisa heads the Marabua Women Association, a group that grows fruits and vegetables for market. Kamisa says her group's 1,000 members come from 5 different payams across Marabua County.
They have different crops that they grow. They grow ginats, they grow maize, they grow simsim, cassava, and even sugar cane. And some of the women are trying to grow even these iris potatoes. And a lot of things that come to Juba, most of them come from Marabua County.
Marabua is 200 kilometers southwest of Juba. Kamisa says, though there is a ready market for food crops in Juba, the women from Marabua are unable to access markets in the capital due to the poor road network. As a result, some women sell their produce in neighboring Uganda, which is less than 40 kilometers from Marabua and easily accessible by road.
You know why our women always sell their produce in Marabua market is because, one, we have very great challenge of roads. Two, means of transport. Even today, as I speak, people are taking ginats from Marabua back to Uganda.
Mary Apayi, Central Equatoria State's Gender and Social Development Minister, says women play key roles in the country's economic development. But she says, despite the many challenges women farmers and entrepreneurs face, she believes with a little determination, these women will succeed.
I'm quite sure that after this workshop, women will be able to get skills that will enable them to manage their skills, to manage their businesses that they have initiated. Also, they will become part and parcel of the saving and credit cooperative society.
Through an ambitious project known as Beacon 2040, Central Equatoria State intends to support all local businesses in the state. Apayi says agriculture is one of the state's key business sectors. Jos Adie Amule, a participant at the workshop and director of Rise Women Hope, a local group that trains women on leadership and management skills, says one reason women farmers are not doing as well as their male counterparts is the use of primitive tools like hoes, making it difficult to farm on a large scale.
They are really struggling because some of their husbands have no jobs. What they know is only to dig the little garden using this normal hoe in which cannot bring big food. It is only for feeding the children and then cannot help. But women are very busy in the market, buying, selling. And then some of them even are buying from Morobo County, even bringing to Juba.
Adia says, though South Sudanese rely on quite a bit of imported foods, her experience with women farmers tells her that the country's agriculture potential is huge.
Can you really be so happy whenever you see only pumpkin, which is about 15 kilos or 20? This banana is so healthy, and then their soil is really so good.
Adia is calling on the government to encourage youth to take up farming instead of waiting for government white-collar jobs, which are scarce in a small town. Both Kamisa and Adia say there is a real need to increase farm productivity.
What we need urgently at this moment, we need the income so that we could go and start implementing them in generating their income generation so that you get power, you get some amount of money which can assist you to hire either a tractor or to hire to make some people to do your work manually so that you enlarge your work.
And if that happens, Adia believes more and more South Sudanese will be self-sufficient in the not-too-distant future. For BOA News, I am Philip Thornaleu in Juba.
The news is not so bright for the future of African farmers in general. A new study says the peace and severity climate change may overwhelm small-scale farmers in Africa. The study describes those farmers as the mainstay of food production on the continent. The findings were released at the African Green Revolution Forum in Addis Ababa. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The 2014 African Agriculture Status Report says small-scale farmers are already struggling to keep up with the effects of climate change. Dr. David Safo Amayau is managing editor of that report and director of strategy Monitoring, Learning, and Evaluation at AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa.
Small-scale farmers are the backbone of African agriculture. About 70% of the rural population in sub-Saharan Africa are small-scale farmers. They produce about 80% of the food need in Africa.
Small-scale farmers grow most of the staple crops in Africa on plots of land usually ranging from 2 to 10 hectares. They lag far behind farmers in many other countries in cereal production, with about 1.5 tons per hectare compared with over 5 tons elsewhere.
About 90% of these farms are rain-fed, which means that they depend on the weather. Whether it's rainfall, whether it's drought, whether it's increase in temperature, they are exposed to these climate effects than any other part of the world. On top of that, most of them use their own labor or family labor. They are not mechanized.
The AGRA report says farmers in sub-Saharan Africa are contending with an increase in average temperatures.
It is being projected that within the next 35 years, the increase in temperature will be between 1.5 to 2.5 degrees. This major rise in temperature brings a lot of issues to African food security. It is going to affect reduction in yield, which is already low, increase in vulnerability to pests and diseases that will kill most of the livestock.
Climate change is also expected to affect the average length of the growing season, which could reduce already low crop yields. Emeyau says to mitigate the effects of climate change, African farmers are urged to adopt what's called climate-smart agriculture. It includes improved soil management.
We are talking about farmers being able to adapt both organic and inorganic nutrient-enriching technology to improve their soil fertility. Things that we promote are the right use of inorganic and organic fertilizer, soil tillage, the right use of cultivating the land, putting things like legume and cereals together to increase the soil nutrient content.
Another recommendation is the adoption of new crop varieties that rely less on manufactured fertilizers or have a higher tolerance for heat or drought. The Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa official says plant breeders are also increasing both the productivity and nutritional value of crops.
In AGRA, what we do is to be able to help African scientists. Currently, we have trained about 200 African crop breeders. We have been able to release over 400 African varieties.
Investments, he says, are needed for such things as research and development, the training of scientists, reducing post-harvest waste through better processing, storage and transportation, and modern marketing techniques. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
The people of the nation, the best thing that they can do is to try as best as possible to cooperate with the health authorities and to listen to and adhere to the suggestions and guidelines. We appreciate that this is something that is really awful to be going through. We're with you, we have solidarity with you, and hopefully we'll be able to end this terrible epidemic very soon.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the impact of Ebola outbreak on Africa's food supply. That story is coming up next.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on the events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We're also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That is South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the biggest barrier to youth finding employment?
Well, the biggest barrier is lack of training. Many youth are indulging themselves in immoral behavior and are not pursuing education. So they don't get the knowledge of working. They are not trained. So that is making them not to find the work.
The biggest challenge to the youths on finding job employment could be a lack of creativity sometimes. If you're not creative and you wait to get out of school and then go to an organization or offices and ask for a job, that's going to be hard. When you get out of school, create something, come up with something, and also, yeah, be your own boss, you know?
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment. Today we are talking about food and Ebola. United Nations Agency warned the Ebola epidemic in West Africa is likely to result in food shortages in the three most severely affected countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. The World Food Program and Food and Agricultural Organization say they are planning to scale up life-saving operations in the communities fighting the spread of the virus. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea are battling the worst Ebola epidemic in history. The deadly virus has claimed more than 1,550 lives, with predictions of far worse to come. In addition, UN food agencies are warning many people in these countries could go hungry in the coming months. In a cruel irony, UN officials note the main Ebola-affected countries have had adequate rain and were looking forward to a good harvest season. But a spokeswoman for the World Food Program, Elizabeth Beers, tells VOA that quarantine zones aimed at combating the spread of the virus are curtailing the movement and marketing of food.
We can see that travel restriction, displacement have already affected prices because food producers are leaving their land to seek potentially safer area. The Ebola crisis has led to buying panic also and prices hikes and the ban on the consumption of traditional protein sources, particularly bush meat, may have implication for the food security and nutrition of the people in this community.
The main harvest season for two key crops, rice and maize, is just a few weeks away. UN agencies warn labor shortages on farms due to movement restrictions and migration to other areas will seriously impact farm production. Beers says the labor shortage also can be directly linked to Ebola.
The majority of Ebola victims are between the ages of 15 to 45, so hundreds of households have all lost one or more members of working age. The reduction of household income, coupled with rising food prices, will also worsen food security.
A recent market assessment in Monrovia, Liberia, by the Food and Agriculture Organization indicates prices of some food items have rapidly increased. For example, it finds the price of cassava in Monrovia's red light market went up 150% within the first weeks of August. Even prior to the Ebola outbreak, the FAO notes households in some of the Ebola-affected areas were spending up to 80% of their incomes on food. The agency says the latest price spikes are effectively putting food out of reach. To meet short-term food relief needs, the WFP and FAO are launching a regional emergency operation to deliver 65,000 tons of food to 1.3 million people over the next 3 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And health officials in Juba say severe overcrowding at two IDP camps is increasing the risk of spreading sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV/AIDS at the camps. Bonifacio Taban visited one of the United Nations-run camps in Jebel and has this report.
It is typically hot, sunny day in Juba as hundreds of internal displaced persons mill about this UN-run ITV camp, finding it too hot to sit inside their tents, locally known as Rakuba. Rakuba stands no more than 5 meters apart. Overcrowding is a fact of life here, but ITV would rather stay here than return to their home in around Juba. They still don't feel it safe to venture outside the camp. Healthcare worker Jal Chul said 3 people have died who were HIV positive at the Jebel camp. Chul said the 3 were not able to access antiretroviral drugs at the camp when they were asked to collect medicine from Juba Teaching Hospital. He said they declined because they were too afraid to leave the camp for fear of being killed. He said they also did not receive the recommended diet for HIV patients. As a result, Chol said their health deteriorated rapidly at the camp. Chol said other people at the camp have tested positive for HIV, but they also suffer from non-sexual transmitted diseases.
In our death record, we have more than 3 cases that are recorded, and they are all positive. Plus the others, 7 people that were treated with other diseases, but they have, and then they were given drugs, then they are also in the camp.
Scholl said young people are at especially high risk of contracting HIV/AIDS because of the higher rate of sexual assault among young people. He said in December alone, more than 10 cases of rape among women and girls were reported at the camp health facilities.
This time, it is most likely the youth that are having HIV positive, although there are some elders people that may have it, but most of the time it is the youth, especially the young girls and the women who are fond rape. The accident which happened last year, so result into the lot of raping. Then some people are fond positive of this disease.
Nyanji Megadiet, a young woman who resides at the UN camp in Jebel, said many young women like herself fear contracting HIV/AIDS. She said the door to her tent is not far from a man's tent.
This issue is the most thing that I personally am fearing of it since I'm residing in the camp, because it is very easy to get the HIV since the camp is congested. The doorposts are near to each other. You can find different families, like a lady or girls staying just reciting together while near the men.
Chol said health worker like himself find it difficult to talk to rape victim and the danger of contracting sexual transmitted diseases. She said victims of rape often are too afraid to tell their story.
They don't want other people to know themselves, so they will give you a condition that tell my name to the others, I will kill myself. Most of the time, I will call for help from the doctors or my fellow colleague, the other midwife. They will give me advice, then I have to give only some painkiller or some for prevention of pregnancy, if there is a mean, if it is just happened recently.
Gadiet said the traditional habit of hearing razor and knife is also a way to unknowingly spread the deadly disease at the camp.
There are many things that are being used, like razors and all this. Since we are congested, another one might use that razor blade, and then by mistake, he or she have forgotten it just somewhere close to you, come there by mistake, and maybe that person also have that disease. You wouldn't know, you will just get harmed.
Jebel camp housed nearly 20,000 internally displaced persons. It is believed to be the most congested of all ITV camps in South Sudan. Health workers here said the country need a better awareness campaign about how HIV is transmitted, how to get tests, and how to get help. For BOA News, I'm Bonifacio Taban, reporting from Juba.
Two new education projects funded by the European Union are expected to go a long way towards improving access to quality primary education in Sudan. The two projects aimed at Darfur and Eastern Sudan, where poverty and insecurity run high, were launched by UNICEF and Save the Children 2 days ago. Geert Kapler is the UNICEF representative in Sudan. He says 70% of kids across the country attend primary school. Kaprea tells VOA fellow Nabil Biagio that war affected Darfur has the lowest rate of primary school attendance.
Out of the 3 million children who currently are not in school, 720,000 are in Darfur. It is critical that we invest in order to get these children back into school. And the contribution from the European Union, the 6 million euro for Darfur, will help us to get a minimum of 100,000 children into school.
I understand this Darfur project is to be implemented by UNICEF itself. And so in practical terms, what are you going to be doing with the grant in Darfur?
In a very close partnership with the government, with the Ministry of Education, but also with the Darfur Regional Authority and the state ministries of education, we will build 100 new schools in Darfur. These schools will also meet the quality of being child-friendly. That means the school will be an environment, offer an environment that is very conducive to learning. We will ensure that in every school there are the appropriate water and sanitation facilities. We will ensure that in the schools textbooks are available, but also the grant will help us to ensure that the training of the teachers is properly done.
There have been many voices coming out about quality of education, especially primary education in Sudan, that it's been degrading over the years. And it's very interesting that your program says quality education. Please elaborate on that.
In Sudan, we have a challenge. A recent study by the World Bank is proving that what children learn in school is not necessarily up to the standard that it should be in 195 schools in three states. And it had to conclude that the children being tested did achieve, in average, less than 40% of what they should have achieved if they would have benefited from quality education. So, together with the government, we ensure that the quality materials are available. We ensure that there is proper school management. We invest in parents and teachers associations. We help building the capacity, the training of the teachers.
What are the areas targeted with the 12 million euro grant?
There are mainly in the east of the country. The grant is focusing on those localities where we have the highest levels of children not attending school. When I was mentioning 70% of children going to school, that is the national average. When we disaggregate by state, when we disaggregate by locality, we see that some localities are much better off than others. So we are focusing our investment as UNICEF with the support of the European Union and other donors. We focus on those localities where the enrollment and retention rate of children in primary education is lowest. So we invest there where the children are most vulnerable.
That's Gay Kapler, the UNICEF representative in Sudan, speaking to VOA fellow Nabil Biagio from Khartoum earlier today. And that brings us to the end of our show for tonight. Thank you for listening. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Please remember to join us tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.